Lecture 9, Virchow and the Cellular Origins of Disease.
Even after physical examination had been well developed by about 1840, therapy remained very far behind. They still had nothing truly effective to treat with disease with, and one of the reasons was that nobody actually knew where disease started. They could describe an organ and they could describe a tissue as having been diseased, but they really couldn't tell where the origin of the thing was. And to a single scientist goes the credit for pointing out that there is one focus, one basic unit in which it begins. The basic unit, of course, is the cell. And the credit for it goes to the German pathologist Rudolf Virchow. He discovered the fact that disease starts within the cell. He pointed out that it was an abnormality of cellular function, that the structural changes in the cell were only a reflection of whatever physiological or functional thing was happening within that cell. So it was disordered physiology of a cell or a group of cells or a fluid around the cells where the disorder began in the cells or in this fluid. But in any event, the cell was the focus. Pathophysiology, altered, sick physiology, was recognized as being the cause of disease. So we go about this time in the middle of the 19th century from the idea of pathological anatomy, sick structure that you can see, to pathological physiology, sick functioning. The organs, the tissues aren't working right because the cells aren't right. When we treat disease with our modern pharmacological agents, we're treating disordered biochemical functions that are going on either within the cells or the fluids and tissues around the cells. And so the key to understanding sickness, the single key, is finally discovered. It's to understand the ways in which normal function becomes abnormal function. There have been many, many theories about all of this for a long time, but not until the so-called cell theory came into existence with the work of Rudolf Virchow was light really shed on the actual facts. Virchow himself was born in Pomerania, far to the east, in 1821, in a town which actually now is part of Western Poland. He graduated from the local gymnasium, as students did always in those days, and in 1839 he enrolled in what was called the Friedrich Wilhelms Institute. That was a branch of the University of Berlin whose purpose was to train surgeons for the military. And he did this because his father, being a farmer, they didn't have very much money. It was difficult to figure out a way to go to the University of Berlin itself, so he would get a degree in the military routine and then try to figure out some way to get out of it. In 1843, he got his MD. He was 22 years old. And then he got the equivalent of a rotating internship, not in a military unit, but at the big hospital in Berlin called the Charité, common name for hospitals throughout Europe. And at the same time, he began working in the lab of a Dr. Robert Frohrieb, who was the autopsy pathologist there. Now, you'll recall that in France, the autopsies were always being done by the clinical physicians. The physicians took care of patients. Patients died. They themselves did the autopsy. But in the German-speaking countries, some sort of specialty was now beginning to make its appearance, and we had true anatomic pathologists, pathological anatomists, as they were actually called, and the clinician would watch the autopsy, but it was the pathologist who actually did the autopsy, and some of them became extraordinarily adept. There was a distinguished pathologist in Vienna, Rokitansky, in the early and middle part of the century, who did 30,000 autopsies himself. So you can see the value of specialization. So Virchow goes to work for Frohrieb. And Frohrieb teaches him how to use the microscope, which becomes the key to everything. Fact, for the rest of his life, just about everything of consequence that he contributes is done because of his skill with the microscope that he learned from Fröhlich. Within 3 years of graduating from medical school, Virchow, who was a hyper-energetic little fellow about 5 feet 6 inches tall with thick Germanic lenses to his glasses, had made 2 of the 3 great discoveries with which we have since then associated his name. The first thing he discovered in 1845, when he was only 24 years old, was that in certain patients with symptoms of fatigue, weakness, difficulty healing wounds, if he simply allowed their blood to form a sediment in a thin tube, a large portion of that sediment was white. Instead of just a small portion being white, when he looked at it under the microscope, he saw this huge number of white cells, and he named this disease leukemia. An important point, because we recognize that until Laennec came along and talked about the tubercle, diseases were being named for its major symptom. Now diseases are coming to be named, a la the French, according to the physical change, the structural change. Leukemia, leuk, white, emia, blood. It's white blood. So he not only was the first person to describe leukemia, but he gave it its name. He also, as so many people at that time were doing, worked in the area of blood clotting. Nobody could quite figure out why blood clots. And as he studied blood clots, he realized, of course, that in certain situations, blood will actually clot within the blood vessels, even though it's supposed to be rushing through the arteries and cascading through the veins, it might clot. And he also recognized that the clot that formed in a particular place could be very, very dangerous. It could plug off the brain, it could plug off the leg. So he gave a name to this form of clot. He called it a thrombus. And we've talked about thrombus and thrombosis ever since. He took it, obviously, from a Greek word. But he also noticed that there was something particularly dangerous about these clots. If they weren't tightly adherent to the wall of the vessel where they formed, they might break loose and travel. So you might have a clot that starts out in your leg veins, and that might travel right up through the right ventricle of your heart and go into your lung. And if it's big enough, it could kill you, just like this. For that, he invented the word embolus. The clot that travels is an embolus. One of the not uncommon causes of death is pulmonary embolus. And we have Virchow to thank for the first recognition of this kind of thing. And he did this in 1846 when he was 25 years old. In 1846, that very same year, he succeeded Fröhlich as the pathological anatomist to the Charité. Fröhlich retired, and in 1847, he established a journal, here he is in his middle 20s, that still exists. In fact, when you refer to this journal, it's called by its nickname, which is Virchow's Archive. Here he's been dead for a century. His journal is still called Virchow's Archive, even though its official name is the Archive of Pathological Anatomy and Physiology and Clinical Medicine. And in the title of that archive, you get what he considered the trinity of understanding disease: pathological anatomy, physiology, pathological physiology, disordered function, and clinical medicine. Incidentally, I should take a little byway to tell you about that word clinical. The word clinical refers to patients. It comes from the Greek kline, K-L-I-N-E. We would spell it to recline. So if someone is reclining, he's sick. So if someone says, I'm a clinical physician, he takes care of people who are lying down. Of course, they may be standing up and they come to his clinic, but in any event, they are meant to be lying down. Recline, decline, all of these are related. When I call myself a clinician, this means I take care of the sick. In any event, because of certain left-wing political tendencies, which I'll talk about in a little bit, the Mahatmas of Berlin medicine were anxious to get rid of this young man. They wanted him to get out of town. and we'll understand a little bit more about that later. Well, the failed revolutions of 1848, which had rocked Europe, had occurred just then. Here is Verco. He's 27 years old. He's done these great things. He's a dynamo of energy. They can't stop him medically. They can't stop him politically. Well, an opening comes up at the University of Würzburg, which at that time was a very important medical school in Germany, and the people in Würzburg want him to come, so the people in Germany say, good riddance, go. So he's farmed out there, and he becomes Germany's first professor of true pathological anatomy. Vienna had Rokitansky, other of the German-speaking schools had professors, but Germany finally decides they're going to have this full-time person. So he becomes a whirlwind of activity and publishing. He produced a 6-volume handbook within just a few years of what he called special pathology in therapeutics. And in 1851, he starts a yearbook of yearly medical achievements. He spoke, obviously, German. He spoke French. He spoke Dutch. He spoke Italian. He spoke Hebrew. He spoke Greek. He spoke Arabic and Latin. So all of the medical literature going all the way back to Hippocrates was available to him. He could read it directly, and what an advantage that was. He started, while he was there in Würzburg, the teaching technique for which he became famous, because he did become famous for being one of the great teachers of the century, in fact, one of the great teachers in all of medical history. He wanted his students to learn to look at tissues the way he did down the barrel of a microscope, and he would harangue them. There was this large oval table, and around the edge of the table was something built like a railroad track that he could control from a button, and there were a number of microscopes, 10, a dozen microscopes, at crucial places where the students sat, and he would set up preparations, slides, put them in the microscope, and he would instruct the students, and when each student had seen what he needed to see in that preparation, he pushed his button, and this railroad of microscopes moved to the next student. So every one of his young men, and they were all young men, had the opportunity of the great man telling him what to see, because it's very difficult to know what to see unless you're oriented. And it was a marvelous learning experience. It was a marvelous teaching experience. The problem was that he was at your ear constantly, and again he would say this thing, learn to think microscopically, by which he meant you have to think in 3 dimensions. You're looking at a slide, and there it is in only 2 dimensions, and you've got to imagine it as you look at these slides, how the whole thing would look in these 3 dimensions. They call that thing the table railroad, and he used it throughout his career. Actually, it was still being used in American universities as late as the middle of the 20th century. I was a victim of it myself, but not with a teacher as great as Virchow. Well, as he was doing his own work and obviously spending so much time with his own myopic eye screwed to the barrel of a microscope, he became more and more impressed by the notion of cells. The word cell had been introduced by the British, I can only call him a polymath, Robert Hooke, way back in 1665. He had, with a razor, cut across a piece of cork and looked at it with some lenses and noticed that the cork was arranged in boxes, really, that reminded him of prison cells. So he said they were cells. So from then on in, anything that had a structure that was like a box, that was biological, was called a cell. In 1838, the German biologist Matthias Schleiden published a paper in which he pointed out that all plant tissues were composed of cells. He had a friend who was a botanist. His name was Thomas Schwann. And one night, the two boys were drinking and smoking cigars, as people did in those days. So Schleiden and Schwann began talking about cells. And Schleiden convinces Schwann that if he starts studying animal cells, he's going to find the same thing. So lo and behold, he takes him up on it and starts putting animal tissues under his microscope. And every sort of animal tissue that he looks at is indeed made up of cells. So he writes this book with a name that only a German in German could think of, with this extraordinary title, Mikroskopische Untersuchungen über die Übereinstimmungen in der Struktur und Wachstum der Tiere und Pflanzen. Now, regardless of how Germanic that sounds, it's actually very simple. Microscopic studies, investigations about the similarities in structure and function between plants and animals. What he's saying is that all organic life is built the same way. It's built out of cells. Well, Virchow reads this and he says, well, that means that disease must arise in cells. If cells are everything, if cells are everywhere, I better start looking at diseased tissues in a new way and see if these distorted, strange, peculiar-looking structures are cells or not. And lo and behold, when he looks at a cancer, when he looks at certain inflammatory diseases, when he looks at what we later find out are autoimmune diseases, he recognizes it's always the cells that are sick, either because they're secondarily sick from what goes on around them, or they're primarily sick and cause disease around them. So he writes an article in his own archive, in Virchow's archive, because by now he's convinced it's not the structure only, it's the function, in which he writes about what he calls the pathology of the future, the pathology that must deal with events that occur within the cell and whose anatomic changes are clues to its physiological or biochemical changes. At the same time, he presents his thesis about spontaneous generation. It had been thought almost forever that tissues just arise. You know, the demiurge creates them, but in any individual they arise, and when the cell theory came into being, that cells arise de novo, they spontaneously are generated, or they arise from some fluid, or what they called a mother liquor that was within the body. Most people did not think that there was no special origin for them. Well, as he did his studies, it became pretty obvious to him that every cell that exists in our body has to come from another cell. There's no such thing as spontaneous generation. There's no mother liquor that creates cells. And everything is traceable back to the very first cell, which is the egg that's fertilized, the zygote, so-called. And his motto in Latin became omnis cellula a cellula. Every cell is derived from another cell, which, of course, has extraordinary implications, not just in ordinary human biology, but in something like cancer, for example, because he could now show that every cancer cell, traceable back through its generations, had once been a perfectly normal cell to which something had happened. Cancer didn't arise because of some parasite that got into the body, this nubbin of tissue left over from embryology or whatever. It happened because some cell or a group of cells had a rapid change, which of course we now call a mutation, a change in the DNA, and that was quite an insight. Well, by now he was the leading pathologist of Germany, and in 1856 he was called to the chair of pathology in Berlin, the biggest chair in the whole country. They built him an institute. He starts giving public lectures to doctors, and he hires some fellow named Herr Langenauer, and Herr Langenauer writes down every word that he says, that Virchow says in the lectures, and before it's all done, he's got this wonderful book that he publishes called Cellular Pathology. And as one great historian said in the early part of the century, this book deserves to be placed with Vesalius's Fabrica, Harvey's De Motu Cordis, and Morgagni's De Sedibus as the greatest tetrad of medical books since Hippocrates, because this book, because it comes from a man who by now is being called the Pope of German medicine, is read by everybody, translated into every language, and it solves a lot of problems for the increasing number of people who are trying to study in an academic, scientific way, at least in the universities, and especially in Germany. Because whereas the French had been sensualists and they were so good at physical examination, that German personality, that meticulous, meticulous, careful personality was perfectly suited to a laboratory, to sit there and make calculations and work things out and approach it from six different ways. And this really appealed to them extraordinarily. So with a single stroke, this book got rid of miasmas and humors and shouted out for the whole medical world to know that abnormal cellular function is the cause of disease. And one of the theses' cornerstone was this idea that a sick cell has to arise only from a normal cell. And there were other implications of this. At the time the book came out, it was a sensation, but 20 years later, another sensation came out when the Frenchman Claude Bernard pointed out that all cells are bathed in something he called the extracellular fluid, or as he would call it, the milieu intérieur. There's an interior milieu in which the cells live, and that brings them their nutrition, it takes away their toxic products. So now people really knew how the body worked. These 200 types of cells we have in our body, there are 75 trillion of these cells, but they're all cells, and they're all soaked in the internal environment. Well, there are other things about Virchow that people have to know to gauge the magnificence of his genius. In the first place, time, of course, doesn't permit a full discussion of his political activities, but suffice it to say that early in his life, when he was 27, he was sent by the government to help out with an epidemic of typhus in Silesia. And he came to realize while he was there that one of the primary causes of sickness in these people was their poverty, their grinding poverty. And for the rest of his life, he devoted himself to what one can only call public health measures. Number one, to elevate the economic conditions and the social conditions of the poor. And number two, to be what might be called a sanitarian, to clean up the dirty sewage in certain cities. Berlin was a mess when he first became involved with this, with his actually getting elected to the Berlin City Council, where he served 42 years. But part of his work on the Berlin City Council was to completely sanitize the city with new sewer systems so that it went from being a real slop joint that smelled, every street smelled, to being a modern, thriving city. He was elected to the Prussian House of Delegates in addition to being on the Berlin City Council. And in the House of Delegates, he became the founder of what was called the German Progressive Party, which was a radical party. Bismarck never did like him very much. At one point, Bismarck challenged him to a duel, which is a story in itself. And this led in 1880 and 1893 to his actually being elected to the Reichstag. So here he is, the Pope of German medicine. He's a very important political figure throughout the country. He's a sanitarian. And about the middle of his life, he gets increasingly interested in yet something else, anthropology. Has a lot to do with medicine, but yet it is a completely different field. He did so much work in anthropology that if you were to ask an anthropologist who Rudolf Virchow was, he would say, oh, he was one of the leading anthropologists of the late 19th century, just as any physician or medical historian would say, oh, he was the Pope of German medicine. So there are these two lives. After the Franco-Prussian War, when he was about 52 and he had written The Cellular Pathology and gotten the journal started, he did more and more work in anthropology. He took part in that famous dig where Heinrich Schliemann discovered the ruins of Troy. He went on digs to the Caucasus. He went on digs to Egypt in his 50s, in his 60s. Roentgen discovered X-rays in 1895. And here is 74-year-old Virchow still going out on digs. And when he brings, let's say, a mummy back from some Egyptian dig, he uses this primitive X-ray machine to X-ray the mummy. He was the person who thought of this idea of examining mummies by using X-radiation. He was writing lots and lots of medical papers, but by the end of his life, he had published 1,180 papers and a few books in anthropology. He became famous, especially during the Nazi era, for a study he did of Berlin school children. I should say German school children. He studied 6,760,000 school children because he was getting fed up with the German notions, the Teutonic notions of racial superiority. And he was determined to show there ain't no such thing. So he did head measurements, he did eye color studies, skin studies, height, and all of this, and he came up with the realization that the typical German youth is not blonde and does not necessarily have blue eyes, and not more than 40% fit even reasonably well that stereotype. And the worst thing he did, as far as the Nazis would later be concerned, was that he pointed out that 11% of Jewish school children have blonde hair and blue eyes. So when Hitler came along in the next century, he took the opportunity again and again to castigate the memory of this anthropologist who dared to disagree with the idea of German racial superiority. So here we have this man who was such a great figure in the new medicine, the new scientific medicine, that he became the model against which virtually every scientific researcher in the German-speaking countries would pattern himself. And yet, at the same time, because of his activity on the digs and studying the material, when he comes back, he's the model against which anthropologists do the same. Franz Boas, who started anthropology in America, was heavily influenced by Rudolf Virchow and his methods. He was not a modest man. He was a whirlwind of energy, and he did a lot, and he was very highly regarded and rushed off to international meetings where everybody was desperate to hear the latest thing that Rudolf Virchow had pronounced. But all that did was to take a tendency to immodesty and increase it. He's famous for having said at one point, when German medicine was developed, it was the laboratory medicine that, of course, was used at the bedside, and therapeutics were developing, and students were coming from all over the world to study at Germanic universities, and you had to learn German if you were an American, or you couldn't study the new literature. He said one day, "When they speak of German medicine, it is me that they mean." And of course, he was absolutely right. Sometimes that apparent braggadocio is not braggadocio at all. It is a reality. Believe it or not, in his lifetime, he wrote more than 2,000 papers. He was the editor for many times that number of papers. He never lost this dynamic energy, and eventually it would cost him his life. On January 4th, 1902, he was on his way to a meeting somewhere. He was rushing in his usual way, and got on a streetcar, and he leaped out of the streetcar because he only had about 30 seconds to get to this meeting room, and he took such a flying leap that he landed wrong and he broke his femur. He recovered from that. Imagine a man of 81 with a fractured femur. But the trouble was that he refractured a few months later, and he was never the same again, and he finally gradually faded out, and he died in September of 1902. As one can imagine, there was mourning throughout the world, universal mourning and a great state funeral in Germany. And it was said at his death that Germany had lost not one, but four great men with his death. Germany had lost her leading pathologist, her leading anthropologist, her leading sanitarian, and her leading liberal.